Blog Talk Radio.
Evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Personal Transformation. My name is Stuart Thompson, and tonight I'm very honored, and I have Blair Champion as my guest here tonight, as I've told you about, I've been talking about. Hi, Blair. How are you doing?
Good, Stuart. How are you?
Excellent, excellent, excellent. I'm just going to get a couple of things out of the way, and then we'll be right on our way. One thing I want to say is, which is very, very important, I'm not here to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. I'm not a therapist, doctor, or anything of the sort. I'm only here offering my own experiences from the gatehouse, my own healing experiences. And like I say, I'm not a doctor. I'm not here to tell you what to do. And anything I usually do tell you related to myself and in my experiences is just that. It's just my experiences. And if you feel that you might want to try that, I would certainly suggest to you that you get a second opinion. Talk to your doctor or something, but take care of yourself and don't take my word as gold, because just because it works for me doesn't mean it's going to work for you. So self-care is most important. The second thing I'd like to mention is, of course, is that I'm broadcasting live from the Gatehouse, as I pointed out from the beginning. We are at 3101 Lakeshore Boulevard, Western Toronto, Ontario, or Etobicoke, as I always like to say. We are here 20 years now, as of June 23rd. Yay. And we're in a community of Toronto, Etobicoke, and we've had over 23,000 people come through the Gatehouse. Isn't that incredible?
Amazing number. Huge number.
Incredible. And we keep getting busier and busier. We are not a government-funded agency. We are totally, totally private-funded. So actually, if there's anybody big wallets out there, big listeners, it's going to sound really crude and rude, but this is what it's all about. We rely on private donations from the public in order to keep going. So we've lasted this long from donations and grants pretty much through the whole 20 years, mm-hmm. And we're still going. So we always have room for more. And the last thing I want to mention before we get started, Blair and I start talking here, is that this weekend we have a few places still left. If you'd like to come and sharpen your skills in suicide intervention skills, we offer assist suicide intervention or suicide prevention training here. It is through Living Works Canada, or rather Living Works. If you go to livingworks.ca, I believe that's right, livingworks.ca, or Google Living Works out of Calgary, you will see what the assist program is all about. The assist program will it consists of 2 days or 16 hours of training, which we provide, and hoping if you're in the if you're a frontline worker, or you work around a lot of people, or in healthcare or anything like that at all, where people might be at risk, then this is the perfect place for you to come and sharpen your skills in suicide prevention. I know for myself personally, I've had to use it even before that, but. Nonetheless, it really helped me out in my skills in regards to suicide prevention. And what it really helped me do, and just so you know, well, one of the biggest things, a lot like what we do here at the Gatehouse, is you have to be a good listener, right? And it can't be about you. It's got to be about the person you're sitting with. And being able to sit there and being present and being empathetic and not, being a good listener, I guess, is really what I'm trying to say. And not, not trying to tell the person what to do or they shouldn't do, or make them feel bad for what they're thinking about doing. They deserve respect as well. Anybody going through this experience is what I'm talking about, is what I'm getting at. So these skills they teach us over the 2 days, you'll find very, very, very useful. We do some role play as well to give you an idea what it's about. And it's not, well, put it this way, it's not fun stuff, I have to admit that, but it's essential this day and age. And being this day and age like it is, society, there's lots going on, and lots of peer pressure in all kinds of different ways, for your kids, grown-ups, everything. There's just pressures are crazy. And anyway, all I'm trying to say is that this is a really, really good course. And if you work anywhere with people to any degree, and where you could come across this potential issue of somebody thinking about suicide, then at least you'll have the tools to do about it and be quite confident in what you're doing. So, folks, we have that going on this weekend, now that I've rambled on enough. Thank you, Blair. I'm really, really happy you're here. Blair, I met Blair, I guess, maybe 2 years ago now, or
three
years?
Yeah,
2 years ago now. And I've had it's been fantastic. In fact, since we started the group, but that's another story.
but
we'll leave that for another time.
Yeah.
And there'll be lots of other chances anyway. But right off the bat, how are you? And could you share your story with us, please?
Of course. I'm doing well. My story. I was abused by a family member. It started when I was around 8, 9 years old. And it lasted for about 3 years. And the abuse was quite regular. It was typically on a weekly basis. And it was pretty obvious to say it was when no one else was around. So I was alone with my abuser. It was a male who abused me. He was 5 years older. And he certainly knew what he was doing. Even, you know, at 13 years old, he was certainly aware of what he was doing up to 16 years old or 17 years old. And I looked up to him at the time. I would say I worshiped the ground that he walked on. That's what I thought about him. So when he started abusing me, I just looked at it as something he wanted. So, of course, I would give him whatever he wanted. I didn't view it as he was taking something from me. It's that he wanted something, so of course I'm going to give it to him. So during the actual time of abuse, there was no concept of liking or disliking it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, this is what has to be done because this is what is being asked of me. So that was what my, that's where my mind was, you know, throughout that time. As part of that, I certainly knew when the abuse would be coming, not necessarily the day, but, you know, when the day came and I knew what the schedule was, then I knew when, you know, I would be alone with my perpetrator. So I knew that it was going to be coming at a certain point. So it's interesting, just that the memories that come back, and I had to live with this for every day. I'm not being flippant when I say that there wasn't a day go by that I didn't think about the abuse that I endured from my abuser. Unfortunately, I decided not to tell anyone for, let's see, over 30 years.
Long time.
Yep.
So in this experience you have now, do you have PTSD and you struggle with that as well? Have you struggled with that?
Have I been clinically diagnosed? No.
Yeah. Do you think you have it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I have wondered if I had come forward sooner. I don't beat myself up over it.
Did you before?
Oh yes. Oh yeah.
I figured you were gonna say that.
Yeah.
But I did the same thing myself. I was just curious. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. I mean, I beat myself up until I decided to go public with it. Mm. And by public, I just mean, you know, start telling some people that are very, very close to me, believing that the time that it was time for me to tell. Actually, what had happened in terms of me coming out is I went to called a Storyline Conference down in Chicago with my wife, and one of the exercises was write your highs and write your lows. So I was able to write the highs, birth of children, marriage, jobs, etc. I was able to write the lows, losing jobs, divorce, different things like that, different failures I've had, not completing university. But it felt like a fraud because the one that I left out was being sexually abused because I had not told anyone. It really felt wrong. So it took a couple weeks after I came home from the conference and I confided in my wife that this is what happened to me. And she is the first person to ever know about it. I need her help and I need to figure out what to do. And so that's how the process of being able to transform from what I was for over 3 decades to what I am and where I'm continuing to go. That's how it started.
Did you struggle with flashbacks and nightmares all that time?
Flashbacks for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember daily what happened to me,
mm-hmm.
yes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would call them nightmares, but they obviously made a big imprint in every single facet of my life. So, you know, what happened obviously was a nightmare, and it was a horrendous experience for those 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But flashbacks, yes, consistently. When I go back to that time now, the big difference is that I'm in control, not of the actual events, because I was never in control then.
Mm-hmm.
And for over 30 years, I wasn't in control of my life. But I am now in control of when flashbacks come. They're not really triggers for me anymore. It's more memories,
mm-hmm.
Horrible memories, but also they shaped every component of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I am not going to go, throughout my day and throughout my weeks and my years, regretting, the past 30 years of my life. That would give more power to my abuser.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that a lot of abusers have too much power as it is. And that would also not give enough credit or any credit to me for some of the good decisions I made, because I didn't make all bad decisions during those 3 decades. Certainly I made a lot of questionable ones,
mm-hmm.
But there were, a lot of good decisions. And I know that a lot of the good that's in me and my character and my personality, would it have been there if I wasn't abused? I don't know. And I'm not going to try and guess at that, because I've spent many nights trying to figure that out and I can't. And it's not, there's no point.
There's no point. No. Absolutely no. No, I can kind of relate to that totally. You think about this stuff and, we really can't go back and change or think what we've done other than learn from it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or at least try to anyway, right?
Yeah, at least try to. And I realized that until I came forward, and then, after telling my wife, there was a small group, and it's still a very small group of people,
mm-hmm.
It took quite a while after that to finally gain control and really feel that I am in control of my life, of my decision-making,
mm-hmm.
And to truly be able to take responsibility for my current actions and my past actions.
Mm-hmm.
My past actions, I don't excuse the really crappy decisions that I made. However, I can see a pattern in terms of what my abuser did and what he caused me. I don't know if caused me to become is the right phrase. I don't know how to phrase it. But he set me up, for a certain place in life that I was at for over 3 decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can kind of relate, because I know, and I didn't even realize it. And it's funny you're saying this, because I think about what my abuser's done to me, and I think how I shaped my life on what they've done to me. All in accordance to what they've done to me, not what I want, but what in accordance to what they've done to me. So every corner or every wink of my eye, or rather if I close my eyes, that's what I'm thinking about. That it was all, and they're not even in my life after all that time. It's kind of like what you're saying, like for all this time, they're not in my life, but they still are.
Yeah. And they always will be.
They always will be.
Yeah.
The only difference is though now, as you're pointing out for yourself, is that it sounds like you've done is you've created a beautiful sense of awareness for yourself, so that you don't get dragged into that. Well, pardon the way I put that, into that shit again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm able to stay above that. My abuser is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
I have very little contact with my abuser, mm-hmm. only when absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm.
He lives in another city, which is absolutely wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And he holds no power over me. It took a long time. I mean, I worship the ground he walked on up until probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I knew that he was a horrible person,
mm-hmm.
and he continued to do horrible things, not anything related to sexual abuse, but just like just being a really awful person. There was always forgiveness. Maybe forgiveness isn't the right word when it came to him. Maybe it's like, okay, you can do whatever you want, and I'm okay with it, right? Because you know you're still up there, and I will still, you know, kneel at your statue, right? Instead of calling you on it, or even cutting you out of my life, or mm-hmm. cutting you out of my family's life or my friend's life,
mm-hmm.
I would still, allow his words to hold weight, which now they don't at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't matter whether his words are sentences are long or sentences are short. His words carry no weight in my life. And one component of that is, I would say, I got divorced when I was maybe 32, 33.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after that time I'd lost my job as well, self-inflicted, that I'd lost my job. I was gambling. And I was taking money from the company I was with. So that's how I was feeding the gambling habit. And I lost my job, and rightfully so, I should have.
Mm-hmm.
They were very, very kind to me. I was in a position of authority, so they needed to make an example of me. So, you know, they did press charges, but they only did so, you know, to make an example, but they still held me all the way through in terms of therapy after that.
Mm-hmm.
However, after that time, my abuser wanted to meet me, and, you know, I still looked up to him. So we met, and he indicated to me that he knew that what he did to me as a child was wrong. And he knew that it really impacted my life, and that it made an impact in the decisions that I made, you know, losing my job, getting divorced, just other, you know, crummy decisions that I might have made along the way. And I thought that was very interesting. And, you know, he said, I wanted to apologize, and immediately I forgave him, because I was still at the point where, and this was going on for over 30 years, that I would rather be the one to blame in a relationship, a friendship, a family relationship, other relationship, even if I wasn't wrong, than to have any sort of tension in any relationship. So I perceived that there might be tension if I said anything other than, okay, accept your apology. So I accepted immediately, and I just wanted that to be over with, because I didn't want there to be any tension or any arguing or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. And we never spoke about it again. And I realized that because of how he behaved after that, like, his behavior didn't change. You know, he was still an awful person. He still made people feel like crap. He still just didn't care about his family. Was very selfish, led with anger, led with low self-esteem, led with jealousy, led with control. That his apology, it wasn't a genuine apology. It was more just to get it off his chest. And he didn't really care about, he just wanted to hear, that's okay. He didn't want to have any sort of resolution to it. Because to him, you know, him telling me, that was enough for him. And certainly the ensuing years, how he still treated me and my family and my parents, you know, that was an indication right there that it was just something to do on his checklist. So he checks it off, and he could go back to being, you know, the horrible person that he is.
Do you remember how you felt, though, at the time that he said it? I mean, being the person that he is? Did it really change? Like, I mean, that's a long time to go back, but... Do you remember how you really felt when he said it? Did you feel? I know I'm really turning up a stone here, but at the time, did you feel it was genuine, or did you figure that out after the fact? So I guess that's what I'm getting at.
I was surprised that he brought it up,
mm-hmm.
because it had been 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and. I remember where we went to eat, and, you know, I remember very vividly that interaction. Sorry, what was the question? I lost.
The time that he apologized to you, yep. Do you remember how you really felt? At that time, did you think at that time, although it was a long time ago, did you feel that he was genuine at that time?
I felt he was genuine at the time because I still felt that he could do no wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if he is apologizing, then he must absolutely mean it. You know, and he can continue going on to be this incredible person that he is, no matter how he treats other people. So yeah, at the time, certainly I did.
Certainly did.
And then when I had time to think about it, but thinking about it, it wasn't until years later. At least 5, 6, 7 years later,
mm-hmm.
that I circled back and realized, no, he was doing this. He wasn't doing this for any genuine reasons.
Just trying to, I guess, I won't say to make his conscience feel better, but rather to accommodate
right.
I was going to say to accommodate his conscience.
Yeah.
Now, your abuser sounded like he was very, very much like a control freak or a narcissist, if I can use that terminology.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He was. And he still is.
Mm.
And that's evident in his interactions with other people, you know, just how he lives his life and the decisions that he makes. And like I said, I have very little contact with him, but I'm still aware of some of the decisions that he makes.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, that narcissism, that me first, that egotistical persona, that absolutely is still him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and still throughout his life, if something didn't go his way immediately, then he would lose control. And that hasn't changed. I mean, I witnessed that behavior, you know, I guess the last time, you know, before I started really cutting him out of my life. So sort of 4, 5, 6 years ago, I would still witness that over any little thing. He needed that full control. And then, you know, coming to the gatehouse and going through the phases, that really opened my eyes to the level of control that he did have over my life, all those decades, and how I allowed it to happen. But allowing it to happen is, that's a dangerous word, because if I am coerced and if I believe that anything my abuser does is great, then and there's so many different feelings associated with it, then how can I actually allow something to happen, right? If I'm feeling shame, if I'm feeling guilt, then I don't know if I don't believe that allow is the correct word, but it still happened.
Now that you've done that, you've cut that tie,
how
has your life changed, that aspect on that connection, aside from not communicating with him? How does it make you feel in other ways? Does that open up other paths for you to follow in regards to how you feel towards others?
I think it hasn't been solely the cutting of the cord with my abuser. It has been telling people, even though it's a small group of people, it's still being trusting people enough to tell them. It is still being seeking help and being open to knowing, you know, especially coming, you know, starting in phase one, knowing that there are a lot of people with similar stories to me, and we are here to help one another and to, you know, get each other out of where we are and to move forward and to be able to live productive, effective, loving, kind, generous lives. So I believe that the person I am now, I still was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. You know, I know where my positive attributes lie and I know where my negative attributes lie. I believe the biggest thing is that I am able to understand more about the things that control me for so long. As I said, guilt, shame, being a people pleaser, having awful, awful boundaries, because not even understanding what boundaries are.
Yeah, I can get that.
And for me, that was, you know, just finished facilitating a phase one group, and every time we get to the discussion on boundaries, to me that is the most impactful.
For yourself?
For myself, yeah.
For yourself?
Yeah, for myself.
Mm. Yeah, boundaries was a great thing for me too to learn as well, because I was a huge people pleaser, and even to this day I have to watch myself that I don't do that. But what really doesn't help, and I need to throw this in here because this is important too as well, but this is the way I was brought up. I grew up in the country on a farm, and I was brought up to help anybody. So that kind of falls hand in hand. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, yes, I'm a people pleaser, but at the same time, that was the way I was brought up. So it was kind of hard to balance that out, you know. This is what I was brought to believe, and not from my abuse, but mm-hmm. from good people. And then I had my abuse, and then I had to, they collided. And now I'm pleasing everybody. Trying to anyway, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, my mom certainly was someone who always wanted to help out,
mm-hmm.
Whether it was family or friends or in her work. She was a very, very hardworking woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I inherited a lot of her characteristics. People pleasing. I think to a certain point, that would be one of them,
mm-hmm.
but not to the point that my abuser instilled in me that's what I need to do, is I just
mm-hmm.
need to make sure that I'm saying yes to anything anyone asks me.
Mm-hmm. Is that awful?
Oh, it's horrible. Going through, so one thing that I remember, and even up to within the 4 or 5 years ago, someone would ask me something, to do something or to be able to help out with something, and I would say yes, and then because I didn't want to let them down, I didn't want them to think badly of me.
Mm-hmm.
And then another person would ask me something different that would conflict with my ability to complete the first thing I said yes to, but I would say yes because I didn't want to let that other person down. I didn't want them to feel like I was being lazy or selfish or I was a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would be a third request. So what I would do, and I did it time after time, whether it was with my partner, whether it was with work, whether it was friends, I would say yes to everyone. And then at the 11th hour, or even further on in the 11th hour, I would let everyone down but one person. I would just decide who I'm not going to let down.
Mm.
And people would be mad at me. They would be upset at me. They would be angry at me, and rightfully so.
Mm.
But for me, that was easier to take, even though it gutted me.
Mm.
It was still easier to take
mm-hmm.
than to have to stand up and say, no, I can't help you because of this.
Mm.
Even though people would be reasonable and say, oh yeah, okay, you've already committed to this, that's fine. You can't help us out, or you can't be there, you can't do this.
Mm.
In my mind, which was warped thinking at the time, that didn't matter.
Mm.
If I was saying no, then I was letting someone down.
Mm.
And that would create a lot of guilt in me.
Mm. Yeah, and it's funny because what the abuse does to us, and I mean what it does to our self-worth, really doesn't help us in that aspect whatsoever. Because, we want people to like us. We want people to, we want to be loved. We want people to be around. But, we lost that conception when we were sexually abused,
mm-hmm.
to what it really, really, truly means, and how we're supposed to feel and how we're supposed to connect. And when it comes to even something like people pleasing, it's all too easy for us to, well, for myself it was anyway, it was all too easy just to do it and pay for the consequences later on.
Yeah.
And which I did many times too, like yourself, obviously a little bit different, but obviously pretty much the same idea, the idea of saying, okay, yes, too many times, too many things. And
mm-hmm.
I caught myself way too many times where I was like, oh my God, I can't do all this.
Yeah. And one of the hard things for me was when, or if I was lying to someone,
mm.
or if I was doing the wrong thing, if I was entering into a relationship that I knew was not good for me, I still was unable to stop myself.
Mm.
I still did not have the tools to be able to say no to this,
mm-hmm.
Or to say yes to this, to make decisions that were healthy for myself and what was best for me. And then, as I started out the family, what was best for my family. So I knew that I was getting myself into situations that were going to be damaging to me. And I still got myself into situations because I just had such, there's no self-esteem. No matter what I projected, and I projected myself as a very confident person. I'm sure in there was, people maybe thought there was, or people believe there was ego in that. I don't know. Maybe I know it's because that's what I need to project. I need to project that I was capable of doing this, that I was strong, that I was intelligent, that I could do all this, even though I couldn't. I wouldn't ask for help. I didn't want anyone to think that I was weak. I would be ashamed if someone asked me something and I wouldn't be able to do it. And throughout my life, I mean, I've just, it's been like, as I've been walking away, walking away from relationships or friendships, not even when they're over, but, even in them, it's like I would just be tossing hand grenades over my shoulders and just, letting them fall. And then the person I'm with would have to, avoid all those hand grenades to try and figure out what is Blair going to throw at me next?
Mm-hmm.
And where is it going to come from? And why is he going to throw this at me?
Mm-hmm.
And what it's worth. Is it worth being in a relationship with Blair? Is it worth being in friendship with Blair?
Mm-hmm.
And throughout my life, I also always sought out people who were more strong-willed than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And more controlling than I was, because during my sexual abuse, I was never in control. I was always being controlled. I was always being told what to do.
Mm-hmm.
During the abuse itself, and then after, I was being told what to do in terms of you can't say anything, you can't act a certain way, or you have to act this way. So I spent decades looking for people to fill my life that would have those same characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you're in control. Okay, you're going to be aggressive. You're going to tell me what to do. You are going to be in control. You are going to make decisions. And even if I don't like the decision, I'm not going to say anything to you, but you're going to make the decision. So I will seethe underneath, but I will never let you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or I will let you know by doing something jerky. Making a bad decision that would hurt the relationship.
Mm.
So it just continued over and over and over again.
Mm, I can really relate. I never had a relationship I couldn't destroy. That's what I always say. And even to this day, I do have some friends, but I don't have that kind of connection with anybody. I'm pretty much an introvert given the opportunity. I'm afraid of making that connection, but I can totally relate to see what you're saying. And not that I won't, I just won't allow myself to, because I know what I've done in the past and I don't want to do it again.
You still feel you're capable of doing it?
I don't think I would so much that I would do that. And it's not trust. It's probably a combination of a bunch of things. And I just probably won't. Just, I don't know. I just haven't allowed myself to do that. I haven't allowed myself to make that connection with anybody solid. I've been on my own for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite comfortable with it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And also, I had the fear of that I might do that again, and I don't want to do that anymore. So I'd rather just stay alone. Mm-hmm. And if I'm alone, then that means I'm not going to hurt anybody,
yeah.
Right?
And for me, it's that you won't get hurt, and you also won't hurt other people.
Mainly, I'm more concerned about hurting other people.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I just wanted to comment on what you were saying, relating to what you were saying. And yeah, it's not easy. Like if a person went through this experience and understands what it's like, it's so easy. Well, I can't speak for you, but I know for myself that it was so easy for me to isolate myself and not have that connection. I try to find people and make a connection. But it was easier for me just to stop the connection and just keep to myself.
Yep. One thing that I was very aware of as I was growing up and in my 20s, 30s, and 40s is why could I never have any long-lasting male relationships? And I still don't have a true answer for that.
Mm.
I believe that certainly part of the answer lies in my abuse. But I don't know why. but I did it. But I've tried over definitely numerous times, dozens and dozens of times, tried to continue and further a friendship with men and just have it be very one-sided,
mm-hmm.
and have it fall off and realize that I am putting all the work in. So why am I putting all this work in when it's one-sided?
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the person doesn't want the type of friendship or doesn't want to have this expansive friendship. So it's just going to be where it is. And a lot of times it's very superficial, and that just, there's a place for superficial friendships, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel that we as human beings have so much more to offer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the amount of love that we can show one another, even strangers, it's very simple if we just, you know, made a decision to. And to me, that also, that comes into play when it comes to friendships. The few close male friends that I have, we are able to hug each other. We are able to tell each other that we love each other. And that's really important for me to be able to do that.
I can't quite relate to that because I haven't brought myself to do that yet, but that's all right. I mean, if it's going to come, it'll come in its own time, and maybe I'm just a little, I'm probably in some cases, without being afraid to admit it, I'm just hard on myself in that matter, and won't trust as readily as I used to, right? And I tend to keep my wall up a little tighter. It's not that I don't socialize, and you know, it's really funny though, Blair, because I go out and I'm involved in things with people, but I go there, I connect with them, but I go home, and that's where it stays, right? I don't come over, I don't have people come over for dinner. I mean, it'd be lovely if they did, you know, I got a beautiful place, why not, right? But that just doesn't happen.
You talked about, you use the word trust, and I find that very interesting, is that for me, I trust it too easy.
Mm-hmm.
But that goes hand in hand with just being desperate for any attention,
mm-hmm.
and for to be in any sort of relationship, whether that's a relationship with a partner, whether that's a relationship with a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So I trusted easily, but it was a blind trust.
Mm-hmm.
I rarely did I do any sort of deep investigative work into that person, mm-hmm. listening to who they are,
mm-hmm.
What their history has been, how they treat other people,
mm-hmm.
and decide how much I should trust them.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost instant.
Mm-hmm.
Because also, if I trusted them instantly and showed them that, then they would think that I'm giving them more.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would want to keep me around.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this stupid, awful cycle that just continued to do damage to me year after year after year.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, that was kind of opposite, because I would do is I would go so far, and then I would believe, trust was always an issue anyway, but then I would believe that I wasn't worthy of their friendship. I didn't think I deserved that friendship, so I would walk away, even though there was nothing wrong with it.
One thing that I know that I've done reading about is how, as abuse survivors, we attach and destroy.
Mm-hmm.
We attach ourselves to people, and then we destroy that relationship.
Yeah.
But we can't help ourselves, and it is very destructive. You're like that friend who leeches on to someone and won't let go.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you don't want to be that person, even though you know that you are going to be that person.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that really opened my eyes when I was going through phase one here was the understanding, concept, theory that when our abuse starts, that's when we stop developing.
Mm-hmm.
When intellectually and emotionally we stop growing. Never even considered that before, never heard that theory before,
mm-hmm.
and it makes a lot of sense. And with the people that I have facilitated and myself, I know that it really does ring true. You know, that when we talk about inner child,
mm-hmm.
right? And how important it is to to make sure that you have a connection to your inner child, but they are not driving the bus.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That your adult self is driving the bus and making the decisions. But the inner child, for me, for over 30 years, they were the ones who were making the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that was evident also in my reactions, and that maybe I would get upset too quickly, or maybe I would shut down, or like a little kid, I wouldn't want anyone to like me. Like a little kid, I wouldn't want anyone to be upset with me. I wouldn't want, the stronger person in a relationship to be mad at me. So understanding that brought a lot more light into my life, and that certainly has helped me, over these past 3-4 years.
So, I mean, you mentioned you were divorced. Now, through all these years, how did it affect you, connecting-wise, emotionally, how did it affect you in that aspect, with an intimate relationship? How did it affect you that way?
What do you mean?
Let me say that again. We're talking about connection and friends and relationships now, in an intimate relationship, how did it affect you in that manner in regards to making your connection and getting through life?
It didn't affect me because up until 4 years ago, 5 years ago, we're 2018, I remarried 6 years ago. So up until that point, I was still so desperate for any relationship that I would be whatever that person needed to me to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not myself there were certainly aspects of me. I mean, as a father, I am very genuine to my children in how I treated them, how I've raised them, how I interact with them, my love for them. But when it comes to relationships, I would pretty much do anything for anyone as long as they wouldn't dump me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does that help answer the question or not?
Yeah. Well, pretty much. But did you not really have with your abuse that you received? Did you not have? Did you? I guess. Well, obviously you didn't have. Before I even go any further with this, having a child myself, I know that when my child was born, reading totally what you're saying, is that my abuse was put off to the side. Other words, I didn't even. If I did think about it, it wasn't for very long because I had a child in need, which was more important than anything.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever my thoughts were gone, and the child would come first.
Yeah.
But when it came to my relationship with my ex-wife, it was a different story. Mm-hmm. I had trouble making a connection with her, but with my child, it was a different story. So that's why I was curious if you had,
My ex-wife is a really good person.
Mm.
She's done a great job at being a mother to the girls.
Mm.
She's a really good person. We live in the same town. We have a good relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it comes to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that because during those years, I got married the first time when I was pretty young, I was 23, that I was only 10 years removed from my abuse, that I obviously was not nearly as developed as I thought I was, and as she thought I was, obviously. She thought that I was, a man or a mature man.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't anywhere near that. So our relationship suffered for various reasons, and I believe one of the reasons was because the person that I had become out of my abuse, the person who had no self-esteem, the person who carried shame every single day, the person who carried boatloads of guilt, and I felt like I had this backpack and it had every single negative component, negative word you can think about someone's character, about someone's personality. And they were in my backpack and that was me. And I carried me with it all the time. And if I wasn't who someone wanted me to be, then they would just reach in my backpack and pull out this word and show it to me. And it's like, okay, that's who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So my relationship with my ex-wife, we had some excellent years together, but certainly I know, looking back, and I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, especially with the growth that I've had over the past 4 years, that that I wasn't a complete person.
Mm-hmm.
So if I wasn't a complete person, and if I was, you know, missing all these segments that were able to make me, good in relationships, healthy boundaries, positive attitudes, then how could I be a good husband to her? So, you know, I believe that in that aspect, I let her down,
mm-hmm.
even though I wasn't aware of why I was letting her down. I might have been aware of it consciously, you know, going back to always wanting to please people.
Mm-hmm.
But subconsciously, no, I wasn't aware that, you know, the reasons why I was letting her down or why I was disappointing her.
Mm-hmm. And probably now too, your level of communication, not just with yourself but others, is probably so different than what it was then, right?
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. It is. One of the terms I used is that for quite a few decades I never had a spine,
mm-hmm.
and then finally I developed a spine. But I realized that what happened is that, and someone pointed this out to me, I thought it was very intuitive that yes, I developed a spine, but I went from being like a jellyfish,
mm-hmm.
to being like the cement wall,
mm-hmm.
and I needed to find a balance. And I'm still working on that balance.
Mm-hmm.
I feel it's pretty good, but I'm still working on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally get what you mean.
Yeah.
Totally get what you mean. And it'll always, for myself, it'll always be ongoing work, but it's always for the better, and it has gotten better.
It is, and when people are critical of me, sometimes it's difficult to take, and sometimes I won't react positively to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I do my best to step back and not react immediately,
mm-hmm.
and try and understand what the person is saying. I am someone who will ask 10 questions if I don't understand one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be really frustrating for people though,
mm-hmm.
because they might not understand how come I'm not getting it.
Mm-hmm.
But until I truly understand it, then it doesn't sink into me and it doesn't become part of me.
Mm-hmm.
So typically at those times when it does, that's when I'm able to incorporate it into who I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that I guess the easiest way to put it is, as you've seen yourself improve since you've come here,
mm-hmm.
and over the years,
yeah.
do you just keep going forward in a positive manner?
Yes. Yeah, for sure I do.
Mm.
I saw that even probably 3 or 4 weeks into phase one,
mm-hmm.
when I was a participant.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the strength that I had to walk up those steps that first week and come into that class with those two facilitators who are incredible men. And then the other guys that we were in the room with.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really proud of that strength, but it sunk in about 3 or 4 weeks in that is an actual something true to be proud of, instead of just this sort of instant pride that, yes, I did this, you know, that's great, mm-hmm. way to go, Blair.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's done. It's like, you know, I've taken this major, major step to change my life and, you know, the life of my family and my friends. So this is something really good that I've done. So let me be proud of that. And not an egotistical proud, but a genuine, sincere proud that, okay, I've taken these steps, so now what can I do to keep going forward? And that's why upon completing, or even before completing phase one, phase two, it was a given for phase two.
Mm.
And then one aspect of facilitating that I really love is sitting there from the point of view of someone who's doing a lot more listening, active listening, than when you're a participant.
Mm-hmm.
And within that active listening, I feel that I'm, in my facilitating, I've learned so much about other people which has helped me grow as an individual. Just because of not necessarily their actual tactile experiences, but hearing their stories and hearing their guilt and their boundary issues and their self-esteem, and being able to have a discussion with them about that, from my perspective and from my understanding, because I can't speak for anyone but me, and being able to have a conversation with a fellow survivor about boundaries, or about my inner child, or about anger issues, or about jealousy issues, or about triggers, it can only make me a better person, because it's continuing to have it be an active part of my life, my everyday life, as opposed to, okay, I've completed phase one, I've completed phase two, I'm going to do this 16-week of volunteer, and then I'm done, I'm going to forget about everything. No, it's part of my daily life, and I love that it is.
So, in the process of you going through this, what do you think was the hardest thing for you to wrap your head around in regards to, I mean, yes, you're aware, but to try to change for yourself, what do you think was the biggest thing you had to try to change for yourself to make you happy?
To set up healthy boundaries.
Just boundaries.
Yeah. Yeah. Because realizing when we first got to that chapter in phase one, and myself as a participant, I was stunned because they listed all the, the collapse boundaries and the healthy boundaries and
rigid.
And rigid. And I, like many, many other survivors, checked off every single one of those collapse boundaries, realizing, wow, yes, I've done this. I do this. I do this. I do this. And then go, okay, so I do these things. So how can I get to the point where I have healthy boundaries, where I'm not that concrete wall, where I'm not that spineless person, but I am somewhere in the middle that other people genuinely respect, and I have genuine respect for other people, and we want to have a relationship together, and our boundaries, and we're able to say what our boundaries are. I mean, that's really important too. And part of those boundaries are saying, well, no, I don't want to do this. Or yeah, I'm okay with doing this. You know? And so that for me was the biggest thing, is being able to have a true intellectual understanding of what those boundaries are and bringing them into my real life.
Yeah, so I can kind of relate to that too, because I know when I started getting boundaries, that's when things really started to change. When I started learning boundaries, that's when I learned how to say no.
Mm-hmm.
For example,
but saying no for me, it was saying no for the right reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Not just saying no.
Yeah.
And that's when the pendulum swung too far to the other side. That I would just say no, because for years all I did was say yes to everyone and anything, and knowing how much it cost me. And then, so I was being, just this fake person when I was saying yes to everyone, and then I was being a jerk when I was saying no to everyone. So, it's being able to say no, but having a reason why I'm saying no, just like being able to have a reason why I'm saying yes, and know that reason is something that I am okay with.
It's a hard thing for me to learn, but once I finally caught on to it and realized the benefits behind it, I realized, well, it's not really selfish. It's just another way of taking care of myself, that I don't do things like you talk about for yourself, because I did the exact same thing myself. And that was kind of nice and refreshing, because it was nice because I wasn't putting myself in positions where I didn't really want to be or deserve to be, and it was refreshing in a manner that, I can say, hey, you know what? I have something going on. I can't make it. That simple.
Yeah.
And take or leave it.
Yeah.
And not really thinking anything of it. Before, I would worry, as you described for yourself, I didn't want to let anybody down. And, now I just don't, I won't say I don't care, but I just don't, I want a life. I want to take care of myself now, right? And if I can't, I can't. I've done everything I can. I'm only one person.
For me, it's also being able to ask for help when I need help.
Yeah.
That's
is that easier for you now as well?
It is, yes. Yeah. And if someone says no, then just accept that as a no.
Mm.
Don't accept it as a personal attack on me.
Mm. Yeah.
And then because that was the mindset I used to have, if someone said no to me, and yet I would, as I said earlier, I would never say no to anyone because I didn't want them to think negatively of me, because I had that warped component in my brain, right? That I was, that I can't say no.
So can you talk about some more positives that you got out of it for yourself? I know you talk about boundaries now, but what about some other things that while doing this here at the house, Gatehouse, has done to help you just in your everyday life?
We discussed, touched upon inner child and how, you know, as I said, I don't want the child to drive the bus.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that's been really positive for me is coming to understand that I am an adult and I need the adult Blair to make the decisions, not the child Blair. So I don't want to let fear be the undercurrent to what my decision is. I don't want anger to be the undercurrent to what my decision is. I don't want jealousy. I don't want spite. So one thing that the phases have really helped me with is being able to accomplish that, to be able to say, okay, if I am making a decision, then it's adult Blair that's making the decision and not the child Blair. So I am not I'm not stamping my feet because I am not getting my way like the 9-year-old Blair would. Even though I might have been 30 years old, I was still acting like I was 9 years old because that's when I stopped developing. So that has been huge for me to have this understanding. The concept that a child or the decisions that a child would make was leading my life for so many decades. And now that child has his place. And, you know, that child and I will have some fantastic times together and silliness and absolute gaiety. But the child doesn't make the decisions for me. It's, you know, it's the 40-year-old Blair that makes the decisions for me. And that is a very liberating feeling because that's when I can be honest with myself and honest with other people and not, you know, internally stamp my feet and grumble underneath my breath. Like a little bratty kid would. So that's one aspect that has been absolutely fantastic. Understanding coming out of this huge shadow of shame and shadow of guilt. What you guys have been able to show me and have walked beside me with as I move forward is to accept what I've done, accept the decisions I've made, but to understand the weight that they carry and that they should not be dragging me down. So I should not be feeling shame or guilt for a decision that I made 20 years ago. And one thing that I find really interesting is how, when I look at the crappy decisions I've made in my life, you take that poor decision and then there's a thread, and that thread, it's not a straight thread, but it'll go one way and back another around here. And they all come back to, the genesis being born out of the abuse that I suffered. And it's not an excuse, but it helps me understand when I made those decisions that I really wasn't capable of making decisions because it was 9-year-old Blair or 10-year-old Blair that was trying to make decisions of a 35-year-old or 40-year-old. There's no friggin' way that I was able to do that if I was 9 and 10 years old.
No.
Right? Mm. So understanding that those threads all went back, and now that I take responsibility for my actions, so that if I make a bad decision, I do not have that crutch is the word that I would go to, but I would like to try and find a different word, but right now I can't. That I do not have that crutch to fall back on, that, well, you know, that thread leads all the way back to my views. Okay,
yeah.
Well, I've spent 3 years working towards not making excuses for the decisions I make that I now make. So I am not going to go back and pin this or allow this thread to go back to my abuse, because this decision is a decision that I made as an adult, that 48-year-old Blair made or 47-year-old Blair made, not as 9-year-old Blair or 10-year-old Blair made. So that helps me to be more accountable for my actions. And I think that's something really positive for myself and for the people in my life. So shame, you know, coming out of that shame and that guilt is really important. One other component that's also very important as well is being able to trust other people.
Mm.
Like I said, I trusted other people, but it was this false trust. It was rarely, it was genuine.
Mm.
If I felt it was genuine, it was only because I was so desperate to trust that person and to not want to lose that person. I think that they always had my best intentions, even when it was clear that they didn't.
Mm.
But it's being able to trust someone because you communicate with someone,
mm,
and you talk with them and you learn about them and you understand them and they understand you and you trust them.
Mm.
So it's a healthy trust, and it's a reflective trust that, you know, that I trust them and they trust me. And so that's something that is also really, really positive. And that came out of those 32 weeks between phase one and phase two.
Mm.
Not being stuck anymore. It's really interesting. My phase two, you know, facilitators, obviously there's a man and a woman, and the phase two facilitator that I had, he was incredible. And one of the really neat things that he would talk about is, he said, "Oh, you know, are you trying?
Are you trying?
Yeah. You know, you're trying to do this. You're going to do this, as opposed to, you know, oh, you are going to do this. You are going to succeed." Or you are going to make the decision, you are going to do this week. And it's only one word, but it made a big impact on me when I first heard him say that. And he repeated it over and over again in our group. And then I actually had the opportunity to facilitate with him. Mm. And it was brilliant seeing him use that in the role of a co-facilitator. So now that is something that I've been able to pick up on when other people are using that word.
Mm.
You know what? I think I'm going to try and do this week, or, you know, I want to do this. Well, how about you will? What is stopping you? Why not, you know, as opposed to try, why not, aren't you actually going to do it?
Mm.
So that's been really positive as well. It's just understanding that it's necessary to, you can say you're going to do something, but you need to actually follow those words up with actions.
Mm.
And I find that as a survivor, that I need to make sure that I am actually following up my words with actions. Because one of the things that I spent the first 30 years, or the past 30 years, you know, after my abuse, is really never finishing anything. I would start something with good intentions, I would never finish it. It would always peter out very quickly.
Mm.
So, you know, being able to back up what I would say now and actually do it,
mm,
instead of just a lot of hot air.
I have Blair Champion with me here tonight, folks, if you're listening. And we're just men talking about our childhood sexual abuse. Now you've done the phases and now you're a facilitator. How does that affect you? Or rather, how has that affected you in your growth to where you are now? Now you've gone and done as much as you have.
Hmm. being a facilitator allows me to keep on growing.
Mm-hmm. Sure does.
Yeah.
Sure does.
Yeah. Because when I facilitate, I'm still being challenged by what I might say or what I might not say. Mm-hmm. And I'm still being challenged by what people are telling me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't matter how many times I facilitate, every group is new people. So every story is unique.
Mm-hmm.
So their reaction to something, you know, so one person's reaction to shame would be very different than mine, and would also be very different from the seven other guys that are sitting in the room. So I have to make sure that I am honoring all seven of those voices,
mm-hmm.
and that I'm hearing them, and I'm able to speak back to them to prove that I'm hearing them. And then afterwards is to be able to take that with me, and I would do this on a weekly basis. I would go through the conversations that we had in our group, and what was something that I learned? And it could have been something that someone said, something they revealed about their sexual abuse, or it could have been a revelation that someone had, or a breakthrough that someone had, or a move forward that someone had. And then the celebration that we would have as a group because of that, or the celebration that I would have with that person, you know, because of that. So it continues to make me want to realize that speaking about my sexual abuse can only bring about positive changes for myself and for other people.
Do you, so how do you, you've done the phase two, right? As far as facilitation is concerned?
Nope.
You haven't? Oh,
nope.
You haven't, okay. So, but this still questions to relate to what I have in mind, but whether you have facilitated or not, how did it feel, although you weren't abused by a woman,
mm-hmm.
How did it feel being in amongst women talking about your experiences?
I had to get over the male guilt.
Mm.
Because even though I am not an abuser, I'm still a male.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other participants in my phase two, you know, they were abused by men.
Mm.
So it took me a couple weeks to come to grips with that and to understand that I am different, and I am under the same classification as they are, as a survivor. And I just hoped that they would see me differently.
Mm.
And they did.
Mm. Okay. Well, that's fantastic. It's kind of what experience I have, but what was it like though, sharing your experiences with women being around? Cause a lot of us men, a lot of times, well, we tend to keep things to ourselves.
Yeah.
You told your wife for the very first time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a lot different than going into a group with a bunch of strange
yes.
people, including women and men,
yeah.
sharing your experience.
I was fine with it.
You were fine with that?
I was fine with it. Because I know earlier on I talked about trust in relationships
mm-hmm.
and how I'm much more aware of trust.
Mm-hmm.
But within the walls of the gay house, for me, it's easier to trust
mm-hmm.
because of the shared experiences that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So it was easier for me to tell my story and to hear their story and for me to open up in phase two with the female participants
mm-hmm.
because I had to trust that they were there because they wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And just like I did. So I was quite comfortable with it.
I originally, it's funny, you know, I had a harder time in phase two than I did in phase one. Because I don't trust men and I didn't trust women because I was abused on both sides. But for some reason, I had an easier time in phase two. So I was really curious how that worked out for you.
It was ultimately easy.
Yeah. And my experience is telling women about my experience, what happened to me in my past years ago when I've done it, was not a good experience. So I was very reluctant to be around other women and talk about my experiences. Not that they said anything really, really bad, to try to shut me off, but they just, other than not say anything, it might as well, say nothing is really saying nothing. And doesn't validate my experience.
That's true, it doesn't.
So I felt basically shut down when I did say it. And granted, that was a long time ago, and times have changed, but that still carried on to me when I was in the group. So I really had a harder time in phase two versus sitting down with a bunch of men in the first phase, where I just blah, 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 blah. Like, it was just so easy.
The females in our phase two were really good listeners. And I believe that helped. They listened, and we had some really encouraging, positive, supportive, challenging conversations. So I like that. I also wonder if part of it is because when we go through phase one, it's male only, and I understand why, and I think that's really critical.
It is, totally.
However, if phase one was men and women, would we look at phase two? If phase two was also men and women, would we look at that differently if we already had that experience of phase one, being a male and female experience?
Imagine we would, but I don't know how many would be able to go through that experience until they talked about the stuff that we talk about.
That's right.
And we talk about the same things,
both
men and women, whether we're even though we're split up,
we
talk pretty much the same things. Our language is pretty much the same as theirs.
Yeah.
There's a few variances, obviously, because of our gender differences, but in regards to our feelings and thoughts, but we're still basically the same emotions all the way through.
One thing I noticed is that there was a lot, with some men it took a couple of weeks, some men it took 10 weeks, but there was a lot more, I believe, genuineness and willingness to open up with a men-only crowd than there might have been if it was male and female, because some men are just, are steel doors anyway when it comes to opening up. When they see other men opening up and being willing to, let those emotions go, let those tears go, let the genuine feelings come out, then that can spur a similar action for other people who might be more closed off.
In my experiences here over the years, I really, really learned to really understand and appreciate this. Granted, we have our phase one groups that are separate, but I've really come to value the phase two where we have both parties there, because even if I hadn't been abused from the other side as well, I still think, and from my experiences, I really value those experiences from both sides, because women need to know, men need to know how we feel when we were violated, even though we're together and we're violated from either side, or in some cases not, we need to know that what you're feeling is oh wow, you're feeling the same thing, right? Yes, you're the opposite sex, but you're feeling the same damn thing I am. And the only difference is there are obviously our gender, but our emotions are still there, and we react differently, but our emotions we still carry the same emotion.
Yeah.
And our emotions, well, this is the horrible part, is how we react to our emotions. Women are in society, as we're brought up here in the West, are, they're soft and supple, and, they're, and people automatically assume that just because they're soft and supple that they're going to be emotional. Not all women are like that. I'm just saying this just in general, and certainly not slamming it in any way at all. I'm saying it in a positive manner, that I mean that men need to understand, even though they are a little bit softer and a little bit more caring, that's important for us to understand, because we're so hard on ourselves, and we won't take those emotions, and we'll just bury them, and we don't cry, we don't do all these other things as we're women have, they're able to do that better than we are. If I, without, hopefully I'm not sounding too,
one way or the other way. I hope I'm not telling one side is what I'm trying to say. But the point I'm trying to make is that both sides are needed when it comes to healing for that. Because I know I needed to hear the emotions from a woman to understand what it was like, what was done to her from a man, and vice versa. Yeah. Right?
One aspect that I just felt really honored with is in phase two, one of the women, it wasn't that she was a woman and I was a man. It was that there was also like a huge age difference between us. And yet the similarities were stunning. But I felt very honored that, she was able to share as she did and be as genuine and honest as she was. Mm-hmm. And in a similar way, when I've been facilitating and there's been men that I have a large age difference with, the fact that you've got men that are in their 20s and that are able to open up about this, I just think that's wonderful.
Huge.
Because I look back and think, what if I was able to open up 18, 20 years ago? Right? What if I had someone to tell? What if I knew about the gatehouse back then?
Mm-hmm.
What if there was something available for me then? But doing so in a positive way and not beating myself up.
Right.
Not going back to, well, why didn't I tell anyone?
Right?
Because, I didn't tell anyone. I didn't. I hid it from my parents. I hid it from everyone. I hid it from my first wife. I hid it from any relationship I was in, from any of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, so when I see men walk through that door and they're young and, we get to comfort level and, find out how old they are, that's for me another, part of my pride and my respect for them and just so grateful for this place.
Oh, I'm totally on board with you there. One for sure.
Yeah.
And that's why I've stayed here as long as I have. It's kind of hard not, I just couldn't walk away.
Mm-hmm.
You've given me more than anybody has ever given me in my life. There's no way I could ever repay back what I received, no matter how much time I spent here, in my eyes anyway. And it's just I'm in awe every time I get a chance to come in here and just talk with other people that have been through the same experience. And yes, it's nasty, but at the same time it's very uplifting and humbling in many, many aspects that most people would really not truly understand unless you were here.
Yeah.
And you have the level of empathy that we show one another here. And compassion, which, I was yet to see this in most places, whether, I won't say a workplace, but in any place of community as I'm referring to, I have yet to see this type of caring and compassion that I see here. And there's no value to it. It's just genuine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really hard to find. And when you have that level of respect towards one another, regardless of your gender, or your color, your race, your sexuality, goes a long way in helping you to move forward from your shithole to something more positive. That's really rough, but that's really the reality of it.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't. Most people that come here, I can't speak for anybody else, but I came here. I was a very, very broken person, and that was a long train just to find this place. And when I say I can never express enough gratitude for what I've got from here, from the people here, the community that's here, of everybody calls themselves different. You're a survivor, victim. I call myself a warrior, but the point being is it's not labels like that. It's about community, about coming together
mm-hmm.
and helping one another to get through this process. And this is what I love about coming to the gatehouse, and this is what happens here.
Yeah. It is very transformative.
Yeah, very transformative.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, when I was going through phase one, it was transformative without me even being aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, around 3 to 4 weeks in, I realized that I had pride in what I was doing, and it became a deep, a really deep internal strong pride I had, but the transformation that took place in me, over especially over those first 16 weeks, it was pretty fantastic. And it was hard because I wouldn't want to talk about it outside of here, you know, because you're dealing with some really crappy stuff and you're hearing things. And mm-hmm. for a lot of us, it's the first time that we had ever spoken with another survivor.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's something it took a while to get used to as well. You know, to be sitting there with these other guys and hearing stories that were, you know, you don't want to say they were worse than yours because everyone has different experiences and everyone reacts to them differently, but equally horrible to your own experience. And, you know, I would look at my fellow participants and I would just have so much respect and so much love for them. Just thinking, you know, you are coming here week after week and I am coming here week after week. And we have people who are volunteering their time to sit here and to listen and to walk with us and to be able to try and nudge us in the right direction and maybe shine some light when they can upon some of the things that we're trying to feel or trying to, you know, maybe they can untangle, you know, got this ball of string that's just completely messed up and maybe they're able to help us untangle a little bit. And just realize how fortunate that I have been. And also that someone saw potential in me to, you know, ask me if I wanted to facilitate, because that has been very, very affirming for me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the highlights of my week is being able to come here and facilitate and spend time with these guys.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're pretty much getting close to our time here now.
Okay.
Now, is there something you would like to say to the world or to other men out there that believe that healing is not possible? That they think that healing may not be possible. I believe it's possible.
Yeah.
Do you have any words of encouragement that you can throw out there at the world, let men know? Even women, too. I mean, it's not just men, but women as well. But men, we seem to be the ones that always seem to be, well, second coming in behind the door. We're not always the first ones coming in the door talking about our problems. And it's changing, of course. The world is different. I mean, never mind just the Me Too thing. You know, there's other people that are doing it, that have been advocating and trying to change things for years and never, you know, never get an eye batted at them for, mm-hmm. for what they're doing. Things are changing. You know, the tables are open. Mental health is important, and yes. and people are starting to actually listen. So, any is there something you'd like to tell the world in regards to that matter? In regards to anyway, childhood sexual abuse survivors, anyway.
Change is very, very possible. You know, transforming your life from one that is led by this little kid that really doesn't know how to lead an adult into having an adult with clear thoughts and clear purposes and genuine, honest, loving motives when they're going to do something or when they're engaging with someone. That is something that is possible. There is light. There's a lot of light. It's just being able to take the lampshade that's really, you know, that for me covered my life for over 3 decades. And then have the light that I am shine out
mm-hmm.
and also have the light that's out there shine in on me. It's understanding that there's hope. There's a lot of hope. There's a lot of joy out there. That there is an ability for you not to live your life as a victim. We will always be victims of childhood sexual abuse. That will be with me until I am dead. But I don't see myself as a victim anymore. So when I think of myself as a survivor, you use the word warrior. I am a survivor. In big part, for a big reason, because of what has happened to me through the gatehouse, through the community that's here. Isolation, can be deadly.
Mm, sure.
And as I said, I mean, I carried this with me every single day for over 3 decades. So that was, you know, I was isolating myself intentionally. So finally being able to tell one person and then trust to tell 2 people and then 4 and then 6, and then to be able to tell a group of strangers, that brings more support than anything I could ever have thought of. To look around the room and look at someone and have known them for 5 or 6 weeks, and yet you feel connected with them sometimes more than you have with someone you've known for 10 years, because you are sharing something and you realize that they are telling you something that they've never told anyone else, and you are telling them something that you've never told anyone else.
Mm.
So the community is so important, the community that is fostered here, and fostered anywhere, when anyone is able to reach out and say, this happened to me, you know, what can I do? Or what is available out there to help me? Or who can I turn to? Or who can I call? It's just, it's communication. It's being able to find that right person at that right moment to talk to. And I think, I shouldn't say I think, I believe that as survivors, we also really need to make sure that we are tuned in to the signs of someone who we might think has been abused themselves.
Mm.
And not turn a blind eye to that. Because too often, you know, we talked about how men don't talk about their feelings a lot. Too often as men, we see something, but we might not call anyone on that.
No.
Is to be able to have the strength to be able to say to someone, you know, ask them a certain question, or have a conversation with them that might be able to uncover, might be able to give you a little bit more information. I ran the half marathon, the Toronto half marathon last October, and I raised funds for the Gatehouse. And I emailed a bunch of people, and one of the people wrote back to me and said, you know, we'd love to donate. You know, my wife and I would love to donate. You know, let me know when you have a chance to go for coffee one time. So right there, like, wait a second, that person has experienced the same thing I have.
Yeah.
And if I didn't raise funds for the Gatehouse, then I wouldn't have emailed that person, and they would have never had me to talk to. And so how long would they have held that on without being able to have a healthy, positive conversation with someone who knows what it's about? And it all goes back to, you know, just being able to communicate and being able to trust in the right people and not being afraid to tell someone about something absolutely horrible that happened to you that shaped your life. You know?
Thank you. Thank you, Blair.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Blair Champion. Really, really grateful. Survivor, childhood sexual abuse, and now facilitator at the Gatehouse. Father.
Yeah.
A year now. Actually, more than once, but this is your recent.
Most recent is 1 year, yes.
Recent. But an absolute pleasure to have you here. And actually looking forward to the future when we do get a chance to facilitate together to do a men's group. And because we started
that
tried to do one
longer than 2 weeks.
It could be longer than 2 weeks. And trust me, there's nothing we did wrong. It's just so you understand, you know, sometimes people want to do things and they think they're ready to do it. And sometimes they're just not ready to do it. And in this case, unfortunately for Blair and I, that's what happened. But you know what? It's all right. And these people are going to come back when they're ready. And we'll be here, exactly.
Yeah.
And some of them moved on and went on another group. So don't worry, it's nothing bad. So please don't think anything bad. It's all good. Trust me, it is. Folks, one last reminder, self-care. If we trigger you in any way tonight, go for a walk, talk to a friend, but take care of yourself most importantly. Number two, I didn't tell you what to do, or neither Blair. We're not here to tell you what to do. So again, take care of yourself. Number three,
Last reminder of our assist training that's happening this weekend. If you'd like to register, go onto our Gatehouse website, which is the Gatehouse, which you should be easy to find, thegatehouse.org. Very easy to find, and you can register online. And if you have any problems pushing those buttons, you can just get on the phone and dial up 416-255-5900. Speak with any one of our staff or volunteers, and we'd be more than happy to help you. But we do have a few spots available left on the weekend if you're interested. It's going to be held here, actually right behind the Gatehouse at Humber College. I'm not sure what room it is. I don't remember it off the top of my head, but it is happening if you're interested. Folks, have a wonderful weekend. Thank you, Blair. You have a great weekend, which is just starting tomorrow.
That's right.
Thank you, Stuart. Hey, you're very welcome. Thank you. And oh, yes, I cannot forget about this. Next week, I have James Buffin coming in. He's been on here before. He's been on for a couple of years, but he is coming on tomorrow, next Thursday. And we are going to be kind of touched base on it last week. We're going to be doing a double whammy. We're going to do the radio broadcast or the podcast, and James is going to do a video production of what we're going on. So we're going to have a live audience. How many people? I'm not too sure. Probably, hopefully, about 6 to 10 people. And what we're going to be talking about, James just went through the court process where he won against his offender. Now, I've heard all kinds of different experiences that people have gone through and done this, and where people have didn't get a conviction and some that did. Well, in this case, James did get a conviction, and he won his judgment, and he is going to come in here, and we're going to talk about that. Now, James, it took him 3 years. I stand corrected if I'm wrong, but it was around 3 years this has been in the court system. So now, next week, we're going to talk about it. We're going to have, we're going to have some great conversation about it, and it'll tell you some things. We'll tell you some things that if you have any any expectations, I'm sure James will be able to answer those questions, whether they be true or false. So please, I would encourage you to tune in. And if you don't tune in next Thursday, you can listen to it anytime after that, anywhere, anytime. Folks, have a great night. Have a great weekend. Enjoy your summer if you're wherever you are, because it is sure hot as hell here. But it's great. It beats 40 below, and I'll take it. So, folks, have a good night. Have a good weekend. And we'll see you next week. Thanks, Blair.
Thank you, Stuart.